All right, there it goes.
All right, good morning. Wednesday morning Bible study, Book of Romans. We're going to finish chapter 13 today. And because it's been a couple weeks, of course I normally do this anyway, let me recap the beginning of chapter 13, and then we'll continue on. Paul, first of all, if you may recall, that these last few chapters of Romans, Paul is talking about, so now what? We've been justified. That's the overall theme of Romans. We've been justified freely for Christ's sake. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is you strive to live a godly life. So these last few chapters of Romans are very practical advice on how to live a God-pleasing life. Okay? So, the beginning of chapter 13, which we went over last time we met, he's talking about, right there, verse 1 says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God. So he's talking about, it is God-pleasing to be subject to the authorities. Did God establish authority? Yes. Why? To maintain order and structure in society. That's good for us, for God's people. God is not a God of chaos. Now, you may recall I said be subject to governing authorities, and this is brought out in the commentary. It doesn't mean necessarily always obey. There are such things as corrupt authorities from time to time. We all know that. There are times where authorities will tell you to do something or pass a law that is ungodly. And so we know from elsewhere in the Bible, specifically from Peter in the book of Acts, if a government, a governing authority tells you to do something which is ungodly, what's our response?
No.
We obey God rather than man. That's what Peter said. However, you're still subject to the governing authorities. So being subject to is different than obeying. Okay? And I don't know if you remember, but I know I read it because it's in my notes. I read a little bit of the commentary that said, if a point comes in time where you're intentionally disobeying or ignoring an authority because they're telling you to do something ungodly, just be prepared that now you're going to be on their bad side, that's my words, that you're going to be subject to their penalties, whatever that might be. Okay? So, all right. And what is the purpose? This is the last little tidbit to remind you of before we move on. What is the purpose of government? Paul points it out right here. This is great for us. Not only from a biblical standpoint, but from just a practical standpoint. The purpose of government, he brings it up in here, I'm not going to read the whole paragraph or so, is the purpose of government is to protect those who do good or to promote the good and to punish evil. That's the purpose of government.
Okay? They don't know that.
No, they don't know that. You're right. If you remember, I talked about, you know, is it allowable for the government to take care of the poor? It's allowable. But there's a problem with it, because then as the government has taken a larger and larger role over the decades to take care of the poor people, this is my opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of the church or the commentary or anything else. I think that as the government has taken a bigger role in that, many God-fearing Christian people have diminished or relinquished their willingness to take care of poor, you know, charity, those who are downtrodden. So it's a good thing and it's a bad thing that, you know, the government has a farther reach. They can affect and help more people who are in need of help. However, as they do that, I think naturally Christians relinquish that. We stop doing it, and we shouldn't. So it's kind of a good news, bad news situation.
The government taking over a lot of this also increases the power of the government.
Well, that's why some of the government wanted to.
Some people today who don't even want the churches or private groups to do works of charity.
Right.
Because they want people to look to the government and that increases the
There's an ulterior motive in some cases. Absolutely right. The last thing to mention, and then we'll launch forward, in verse 7, which is where we ended, Paul says, pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes is owed, are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. I think in context, that's a reference to various different authorities, governmental entities. Some of them you pay taxes to, some you pay revenue to, some you simply owe respect and honor. But I do think this applies to everyone. It applies in addition to all authorities. You know, parents to children, citizens to policemen, you know, students to teachers, yeah. Any authority. We owe all of that to authorities. All right. I think that gets us caught up. Any questions so far? Okay, moving forward. Verse 8. Owe no one anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Owe no one anything. Now, some Christians throughout church history have interpreted this to mean you cannot borrow or lend money. That's wrong to borrow or lend. There are Christian groups still today who would say that. That simply to borrow money or to lend money is wrong. They go so far as to say sinful. But Paul is not saying that. He says, owe no one anything. I kind of agree with the Dave Ramsey approach on this. Some of you familiar with Dave Ramsey?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
He's on the radio. I've heard him on occasion. It was... It seems like it was right at the start of COVID. We did the Dave Ramsey financial thing here, and we had a handful of people that came to it or so. I have heard him a few times on the radio, and I pretty much agree with all of his advice, with maybe one slight exception. But he doesn't try to give theological advice. He's giving sound financial advice. And I remember hearing one little snippet one time where a caller called into him, and they had an opportunity to get out of some debt, student loan or something. There was a loophole. And he said, well, if I take advantage of this and do this, this, and this, I can wipe away that debt. And Dave Ramsey's response was, I like this. Dave Ramsey's response was, did you borrow the money? Yes. Then you need to pay it back. Mm-hmm. That's the right thing to do. Even if it takes longer, or you have to structure your budget in a certain way, or you have to eat beans and rice for a year. You know, that's what he says a lot. And I agree with that. If you borrow money, you pay it back. If you'll allow me a moment to stand on a soapbox and rant for a minute.
Go ahead.
Really?
Go ahead.
This is a bit of a vent. The whole idea of canceling student loans for college students.
Yes.
I took out a few student loans. Now, I managed it. I graduated, I had probably $10,000 or less in student loans. I paid it off in about 2 or 3 years. I was diligent about it. I know other other graduates, they do that too. So the idea that there's this movement right now to cancel student loans, frankly, that just cheeses me off. You borrow the money, you gotta pay it back.
Exactly.
And if it's too much, you shouldn't have borrowed so much. You know, go to a different college or a cheaper college or take part-time classes or work while you do it. If you're borrowing $100,000, then probably you shouldn't be borrowing that and going to that college or going to that degree. Yeah, Ellen?
And then to me, what that amounts to is making the people who couldn't afford to send their kids to college pay for these other kids' college.
Yeah, right.
You know, that isn't right.
Right. Yeah, Don?
That's akin to the same thing as people that owe back income taxes, and they go to these agencies that, you know, we can cut it down to half or whatever. I mean, if they owe it, they owe it.
Yeah, right.
Who's paying for that gap?
Well, in the last little bit of my rant, sorry, some of you know I do have a... Oh, Bob, can you get a refill for Bob there?
Sure.
Some of you know I have a business background. And so to reference an idea from Milton Friedman, he's a well-known economist. He said there is no such thing as debt forgiveness. Somebody is paying it. So if the government tells, makes a declaration because of some political movement that's happening that we're going to forgive all student loans, actually they're not forgiven. That means the people who loaned the money are eating the cost. They're absorbing it. They're paying it themselves. Somebody is paying for it. And so, sorry, there's my rant. Okay? I paid back my student loans. I don't like it that other people don't.
Yeah.
Or won't. Or don't want to.
You're
right. Yep.
All right, there. Exactly. Sorry, got that off my chest. Any comments or thoughts?
Just, we listen to Dave Ramsey a lot, too, and we were listening one day, and this man called in, and he said he had borrowed $400,000. He went all through medical school.
Wow.
And he couldn't pass his board.
Oh, my goodness.
He was never going to get a job that was going to pay enough to pay off the $400,000.
Wow.
Yes. So, I mean, we both heard it at the same time. We're like, what?
Yeah, that's incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, I know medical
medical
students incur a lot of student loan debts, but they're also very well paid. So if they get out and they get a good job as a doctor, a surgeon, whatever, they should be able to pay back those loans in a matter of 5, 6, 8 years. But yeah, what if you don't pass your boards and now you can't practice medicine after all that debt?
Yep.
Oh, that is incredible. All right. Okay. All right, enough of my ranting. Sorry, that's the only rant you'll hear for this whole Bible study.
Sure.
Okay.
I'm not supposed to say that right now.
Should I write that down?
Yeah, you can write it down. All right. Owe no one anything except, Paul says, to love each other. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. There is one debt that we all have and will always have. To love one another. It starts with loving God. That's implied here. Loving God and loving one another. Do you ever pay off that debt? No.
No.
Are they supposed to love you too as well? Yes.
Yeah.
We love each other. We love God. That is a debt that will never be paid. And that is a debt we will still have in heaven. Yeah. And also, obviously, part of the reason we have that debt is because Jesus paid it. He died on the cross for us. We can never repay that debt back. So how do you thank Jesus, or how do you respond to Jesus that he paid our debt of death for us? So we pay him back by loving one another. That's the point here. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. Then Paul continues, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, first of all, he quotes four of the commandments here, all from the second table of the law, kind of the heart of the second table of the law. 5th, 6th, 7th, and 9th, and 10th. So what is the second table of the law all about?
Our relationship.
Right. Loving one another. What's the first table of the law? The first three commandments.
Loving
God. So he's quoting the second table here, and then he quotes Jesus. Jesus was asked the question, what's the greatest commandment? And how did Jesus respond? He gave a two-part answer, right? Love the Lord your God, and love your neighbor as yourself. Right there. He's quoting Jesus. So, you know, he's in good company there, I guess.
Yes, right.
Certainly. Now, I have to tell you, I picked this up out of the commentary as I was reading. I've talked about or expounded upon the Ten Commandments in multiple Bible studies when it's come up. One thing that I had not yet realized until reading the commentary for this is the prelude to the Ten Commandments. The verse right before the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, it actually starts like this. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And then he goes on. Okay? So how do the Ten Commandments actually begin? I never thought about this till I read it from Dr. Middendorf in the commentary. The Ten Commandments begin with God identifying himself and giving you an identity. What is God's identity? He brought them out of slavery. What is Jesus' identity to us? He brought us out of slavery to sin and death. And therefore, you shall have no other gods before me. When you realize what God did for us, his identity, he is your God, and he saved you freely, without any expectation back. That's his identity. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods. When you realize what God did for us, what Jesus did for us, How do you respond? You want to say thank you? Here's 10 ways. That's basically what God is saying. So all times that I've always taught and explained and expounded upon the Ten Commandments, I hadn't really noticed the kind of the prelude to it, which establishes the whole purpose of the Ten Commandments. You see that? That connects right here. How do you want to show love to God? Strive to fill the commandments. What do we call that as Lutherans? First, second, or third use of the law?
Third use.
Third use. Do you guys remember me talking about this early on in this Bible study? As Lutherans, we would say God's law has three uses. First use is curb, right? To maintain order in society. We just talked about structure and authority to maintain order, curb. The second use, which is the one we talk about most as Lutherans, is mirror. God's law is a mirror to remind us we're sinners. Otherwise, we deny it, we ignore it, we make excuses. The third use of the law, I learned it as guide. Some of you might have learned it as rule or ruler. The third use of the law is, how do you want to be pleasing to God? How do you want to live so that you can say thank you to God? Strive to follow the Ten Commandments, the third use of the law. That's what this is. Third use of the law right here, okay? All that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're all Lutheran, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Verse 10, love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Jesus said that too. What's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. However, here's a bit of a conundrum. I'm going to throw you a curveball. It is baseball season, right?
Yeah.
Here's the curveball. Paul said early on in this very letter, in Romans, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All have sinned. No one can fulfill God's law. Love is the fulfilling of the law. So which is it, Paul? Can we fulfill the law or not?
Yes.
What's the answer?
Yes.
There you go, yes. Yeah, okay. I know you're on to me.
No.
Yeah, Ellen?
I think that proves that it is not good works that save us.
Sure.
It's another way of saying it.
It's another way of saying it's not works that save us. Right. Yeah, good. I think that's true. Any other thoughts? There's two different ideas going on there. When he says no one can fulfill the law, no one can fulfill the law for what purpose? To save us. As you said, Ellen, for good works will not save us. However, can we fulfill the law out of thankfulness for what Jesus has done by loving one another? Yes. However, I would also say we can't even do this perfectly, can we?
No.
None of us really, truly do this. Love is the fulfilling of the law. We should and could strive to love one another in order to fulfill God's law, and we still do that incomplete and imperfectly. Right? Mm-hmm. So we still need forgiveness even for that. So, yes, there is a little bit of a tension here because of love is fulfilling the law or not fulfilling the law. All right, I want to read a quote for you from the commentary about this verse right here. So let's see. Let me find it. There we go. Love and law's fulfillment. Bear with me, it's one paragraph. Are all the commandments then simply reduced to love? Does the command, you will love your neighbor as yourself, somehow replace all of God's other commandments? This conclusion would present just as much of a false alternative as the one exhibited by the Pharisees. In legalistically obeying the commandments, they ended up omitting love. That is, as Jesus charges, the more important matters of justice, mercy, and faithfulness. But today, the mistake more often occurs in the opposite direction, where love, as defined by our self-absorbed permissive society, takes precedence over all else. The reason I wanted to read that is because there is a balance between love and obeying the law. And so the Pharisees strive to obey the law at the neglect of love. Jesus chastised them for that multiple times, right? You place burdens upon them that they cannot fulfill. There's a balance between that. What is it's the opposite today, isn't it? You should love other people. It doesn't matter whether you obey the law or not. So there's this idea in our modern culture that love means you agree with or permit any sort of action. And when you do that, you ignore God's law. Yeah, Ellen?
There's a Bible passage also that says, faith without works is dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there aren't any works, even though we don't need works to be saved, if there aren't any, that might mean there isn't any faith.
Yeah, that's true, right. So works of striving to fulfill the law. Yeah, Bob?
I suppose some of the confusion is I keep putting law as in civil law instead of the Ten Commandment law.
Yeah, right.
It keeps getting in the way every time I read it, and I can't get rid of that saying, okay, you got to obey the law.
Right.
Which, you know, being human, I can't get rid of the laws put on from my outside.
Sure, and certainly he's referring to the moral law here, the Ten Commandments. Yeah, okay. Right. So there is this balance, this tussle between love and obeying the law, right? Do we strive to obey the law? Yes, and in that manner we love. We love God and we love one another. Does love mean sometimes overlooking God's law? Well, maybe temporarily, momentarily, but that's a little dangerous for me to even say that. You know, love includes striving to protect someone from themselves, which means telling them they're doing something wrong that's harmful. So that is loving, while also striving to obey the law. See, there's a balance in there. And at the time of Jesus, the Pharisees were overbalanced toward striving to obey the law in every minute detail and ignoring love of the neighbor. Today, I think we're overbalanced in terms of, well, you have to love your neighbor. You don't love your neighbor. You're telling me I can't do that, or that that's wrong, that I shouldn't be doing that action or that lifestyle. Well, that's not loving. Well, no, actually, I'm trying to be loving by telling you that's harmful to yourself and others. So, yeah, there's this weird struggle between those, especially today, too.
Well, and that's true for a lot of young Christians, I think. They've bought into this inclusion kind of thing, and you love everybody no matter what.
Yeah.
And I've got a couple daughters who struggle with that. Some of the things they post on Facebook, I'm just going, no, that's not what God wants people to be like or to be doing. And
right.
And so then there's also a tension between them and us, because you need
sure.
to see it differently.
Tension, that's the right word. There is a tension between law and love. There's a tension. And between us and others, there's a tension. Yeah, right. Good. Other comments or questions? All right. Good. Let's go on. Verse 11. Besides this, you know the time, that the hour has come for you to wake from sleep. For salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed. You know the time. What is he referring to? You know the time. What is the time? What's he referring to? Oh, it's 10 o'clock. You know the time. It's the first hour of the day. You know, was that what he's referring to?
No, talking about the end times.
Yes, the end times. He's talking about you know the time. It's the end times. I would say this. There are three great events in human history according to God. The first one was creation. God is love, so he loved and wanted more to love. He created you, all of creation. The crowning pinnacle of creation is you, humanity. First thing. The second great event between humanity and God is Jesus. Living the perfect life, dying and rising again. Our redemption, saving us from ourselves. The third great event in human history in regards to God, Judgment Day, when God will say, okay, enough is enough. All of you who are believers in me, come into the joy and bliss of heaven. Wonderful. Woohoo! Cheer. You know, sometimes I'm really ready for it.
Yes.
You know, you see the news or you see all the problems and I see all, you know, That list that we prayed for this morning of people with health issues is longer than it's been in a long time. And I've talked to a few people recently. Sorry, this is a little bit off topic, but I've talked to a few people who said, you know, we know this person with cancer, this one with cancer, this one with this problem, this one, this problem. Why all these people? I mean, normally there's, you know, one or two here or there. You're praying for them. You're trying to help. All of a sudden, there's all these people. I said, I don't know. The devil is active. He's having a field day right now. I don't know. I don't get it. God, I think we're ready. You can come tomorrow at 10 o'clock. That's a good time. That would work for me, okay? Jesus, come on. We're ready. Sometimes I feel that way.
As my dad said, thy kingdom come.
Yeah, that's right.
Right now.
Absolutely.
Sooner the better. Yeah.
So, the three great events in human history between humans and God were past halftime. All of those sports people were somewhere in the fourth quarter.
Yes.
The ninth inning.
Yeah, the ninth inning for baseball folks. Yes, okay. The ninth inning. Right. So, you know the time. It's coming close. How much longer? Could it be a day? Could it be a year? Could it be another 100 years? Yeah, we don't know. But it's, I mean, in the whole span of human history, it's close.
Yeah.
That the hour has come for you to wake from sleep. What does he mean? You know what he means. This is representative. The hour has come for the time for you to wake from sleep. What might he be referring to?
Be alert.
To be alert.
Yes. Be alert. Jesus talks about that too, right? The bridegrooms or the bridesmaids, be alert, be awake. You don't know when the groom is going to come, that whole thing.
Be ready.
Be alert. Be ready. Do we as Christians, and I think this is true across Christianity, and I think it's true in Lutherans too, do we get a little complacent?
Yes.
A little lulled to sleep?
Yeah.
We're in our own little enclave here. We know each other. We're doing fine. Yeah, that's a mess out there, but let's stay. It's okay. That's good to be in our own little enclave. But we still need to go out there and be alert that there is a mess out there, and each one of you is a little gospel light out there. Okay? Let it shine,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, the hour has come for you and me to be awake. Now, interestingly, this word sleep in Greek, this doesn't really change the meaning or the teaching moment here, other than it's just a nice little trivia connection. The word for sleep here is hypnos. That's the actual Greek word there. I looked it up. Hypnos. So wake from being hypnotized.
Exactly.
That word hypnotized comes from the Greek word to sleep. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Wake up from your stupor. Paul is saying, be alert, be ready, it's coming, the hour is coming, for salvation is nearer to us now than when we first believed. Every day, we're one day closer, right?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, then I like this little illustration he has here, verse 12. The night is far gone, the day is at hand, so let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Now, it may be less true at this stage of the year in the calendar that you see the dawn. Maybe some of you do. I don't know how early you get up. But you know, in the winter, when the sun doesn't rise till 8 o'clock or 8:30,
yeah.
Most of us are usually up by then. And I have this vision, this image of this right here. There's been a few times where I've been out on someone's boat, and the sun is rising. And you just see the glow of the sky before you even see the sun. And you know it's coming. It's a matter of, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, but it's starting to get light. You see a little bit light blue, and then the light blue turns to this neat color of maybe green or orange. And then eventually there's just the sliver of the sun peeking up. That is life for you and I right now. Jesus is coming. We see the evidence of it. The sun is peeking up. We have hope for the future. It's coming. Now, it's still night. You look up, you know, in that situation, out on a boat, out on the beach, or just standing in your front yard and seeing the sunrise. You look up, and it's still dark blue. You look in the opposite direction. Let's see, sunrise is in the east. So you look that way. It's still dark blue.
Yeah.
Maybe even still see a few stars over there while the sun is coming up over here. Can evil and crime and sin still be committed in the night?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and it is, isn't it?
Yes.
In our world. But we see that Jesus is coming. The day is at hand. What a glorious thing, right? Mm-hmm. Let it fill you with hope for the future. Then let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. So for all of this, what do? We strive for the light. Now I like how Paul phrases this here. Cast off the works of darkness. Who's doing something? We are. We are doing works of darkness at times. All of us continue to sin. Cast those off. Something we need to do is fight against temptation. Casting off those works of darkness. But look at the opposite of that. Is the armor of light something we do? No, it's simply put on you. It's put on you to protect you. The armor of light is the gospel message. It's the word of Christ. It's the forgiveness of Jesus. It's justification, right? There's justification. So to protect yourself from the works of darkness, you're not actually doing anything. You're simply wearing the armor of light. On the flip side of that, we do need to do something. We need to fight against the works of darkness that are within us and around us. So we fight against evil in the world, and we fight against sin within ourselves. Okay? Does all that make sense? I really like this turn of phrase here from Paul. Cast off the works of darkness, but put on the armor of light. How wonderful. All right. And then he gives very practical examples of this. Let us walk properly as in the daytime. So be upstanding. Be a God-fearing person in your image, in your reputation. That helps to promote the good. Remember, that's what authorities do. They promote the good. Properly as in the daytime. Not in orgies and drunkenness. Not in sexual immorality and sensuality. Not in quarreling and jealousy. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. Now let's talk about this list of sins here that he mentions. Not in orgies and drunkenness. Now, for me, sorry to be a little bit crass and direct, but that word orgy to me has a sexual connotation. But that's not what's meant here. Okay? I looked it up. The word there means revelry, carousing. Or, to use it in a modern word, partying. Okay? So really what he's saying, back then, what the ancient people would refer to as an orgy is excessive celebration, gluttony. And it usually went with drunkenness. Because if you're eating too much and indulging too much, you're also drinking too much. So these two go together. So I would say in modern words, we would translate this, not in partying and drunkenness. Now, is it okay to celebrate?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Is it okay to party, as the younger people might say? I'm no longer a younger person. And my boys would cringe if I say, hey, were you out partying last night? Nobody says that anymore.
Well, we had an orgy.
Yeah, right. That's not any better, right?
No.
So, yes, it's okay to celebrate, but the problem is if that's your purpose for living, and that's what you dwell on, and you overdo it. Jesus, you know, in the Bible, we know drinking itself is not bad, but what is bad? Drunkenness. Can you have a drink? Yes, but drunkenness is bad. Can you have a celebration? Yes, but if you dwell on it and obsess over it and do it to excess, that's bad. So that's what that word means there, okay? So those two actually go together. Then the next two go together also. Not in sexual immorality and sensuality. So those two go together. Now this one does have a sexual connotation. And let me point out to you the actual, this will ring true. This phrase right here, sexual immorality, is actually one word in Greek. It's the word coitus. Okay? So yes, it means sexual intercourse. Not in sexual intercourse and sensuality. Sensuality means licentiousness or hedonism to the exclusion of sexual intercourse, okay? You know somebody who might be Have you ever encountered somebody who's a little bit crass and licentious and maybe a little overboard in terms of, sexual innuendos?
Oh, yeah.
That's what that's referring to, sensuality. So we should not participate neither in the act nor in the, I don't know, what's the word I could use there? Sensuality is a good word, but let me see if I had anything else. Debauchery. How about that? Okay? So that's what this is referring to. And then he says, not in quarreling and jealousy. Well, these seem like pretty big sins here. Public sins. Excessive celebration, gluttony and drunkenness, sexuality and sensuality. Those are big things. Quarreling and jealousy? Those are in this list? Well, that hits a little home at home, doesn't it? Oh, yikes. Yeah, that kind of hits a little close to home there. And actually, the word quarreling there means strife. Quarreling is an okay translation. I think it's all right that the ESV put that there. But it means strife. So don't be the source of or engaged in strife and conflict with other people, which usually is what quarreling is, okay? Disputing something with someone. So that's quarreling. Jealousy. This word is probably not the best translation, because the word here is zeal. Not in strife or zeal. Now that's puzzling, but let me explain it this way. Zeal can be either good or bad, right? Can you have zeal for the Lord?
Yes.
Yes. That's a good thing. Can you have zeal to pursue your own pleasures? Yeah. That's a bad thing. Can you have zeal for acquiring money? Yeah. That's probably a bad thing too. So zeal is either good or bad. Jealousy, which, while I would say that's not the best translation, but to put zeal there would be misleading to English speakers today. So jealousy probably is a better translation, even though it's not a faithful translation to the original Greek word there. But jealousy is good or bad, right? Is our God a jealous God?
Yes,
he does not want you going after false gods. That's a righteous jealousy. But when we're jealous that somebody else has something that we want, a nicer car or whatever, that's a bad jealousy. So jealousy can be good or bad too. Bob, you had your hand up.
I was just going to say jealous God.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Like-minded. Very good. So, not in strife or zeal. Should we have zeal? Yes, zeal for the Lord, but not zeal for sinful things and sinful actions. That is what we should avoid. Jealous envy. Jealous, zealous envy over other things. Okay? All right. Comments or questions? Last verse. But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. Put on Jesus. When does that happen?
Baptism.
Exactly right. In your baptism, you put on Jesus, or more properly said, Jesus is put on you. We don't do it to ourselves. Jesus is put on you in your baptism. And so you are, it's part of the phrase even, you're clothed with the robe of Christ's righteousness. How wonderful. I just did a little, was it during one of the Lenten services? I did a children's message where I talked about putting on my pastor's robe.
Yeah.
Was that in the children's message?
I think it was.
In one of the early services in Lent.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. A lot of times pastor's uniform is what color?
White.
Fine.
No.
Underneath?
Black.
Black. A black shirt, black pants, little white tab there. Black. Black is the color of sin. But then what do we put over top of that? A white robe. Ah, it represents the white robe of Christ's righteousness over top of our sin. Do we still have sin underneath?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Until the day we get to heaven. We still have sin underneath, but what covers that over? The robe of Christ's righteousness. His righteousness covers us up, makes us holy and pure in the sight of God. Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. So we should not... Here's what I would say for this. Somebody who's got a sinful tendency, maybe a little sinful addiction for this or that or the other thing. You know, there are tons of addictions, not just alcohol and drugs, but lots of things. I am witnessing a explosion of addiction to video games among kids right now.
Yes.
Well, frankly, adults too.
Yes.
You know, Jill will mention to me, and I'll mention to her sometimes, like, how long are you going to play on your phone there? I'm just playing solitaire, which I am. I love solitaire. I have an app that has 150 different versions of solitaire. I don't play the standard Klondike. That's boring to me anymore. I play all the other ones.
Spider and
Free Cell and all the rest, yes. And she'll say, you know, why don't you put your phone down and engage with us? Okay, yeah, that's true. There is an explosion of addictions. All sorts of them. Not just drugs and alcohol, but TV and entertainment and pleasure and video games and, you know, other things like that. You do not let this thought get in your head, because this is the devil speaking. Well, just do it this once. It'll satisfy your desire. You can gratify that desire, and then you can go on with life for a while. No, as soon as you indulge in your sinful addiction once, what happens? You want more. And it's hard to put the phone down, or hard to put the TV remote away, or hard to, you know, relinquish the, get rid of the drink, or whatever you're addicted to, you know, various addictions. Do not gratify the desires. Not even once. That's the devil's thinking to say, just do it one time, it'll make you satisfied. No, it won't. It's empty. It's empty. It doesn't do that. So, some very practical advice from Paul. And all of this finishes chapter 13. So there we go. See if I got anything left in my notes. Any questions or comments? I think I got everything. Yeah. All right. And then there was silence.
We're still trying to take it all in.
Well, there's a lot to take in, absolutely. Okay, very good. Well, nice to see you all back. Nice and sunshiny day. Enjoy the rest of the day. And remember, we're just going to keep chugging along on Wednesdays. We'll meet for 3 more weeks, and then we'll break for the summer. And if you do flip to the Tuesday, just keep in mind they're out of sync for a couple weeks. So one thing you can do is, I am still posting the audio files on the website, so you can always go there and find them. And if you miss one, catch up there. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Good Bible class.
Thank you.